Hello and welcome to episode 14 of the Office Block podcast. We cover issues for people at work, particularly in banking, finance and tech. I'm Paul Dillon. I'm joined today by my Office Block co-pilot, Anne-Marie Butler. What's the story, Anne-Marie?
All good. Thanks, Paul. Looking forward to today's show. We've two brilliant guests who've just joined us here in the podcast studios. We've got Laura Bambrick from the Irish Congress of Trade Unions and Denise Roach from the National Women's Council of Ireland. You're both very welcome on the show. Today we're marking International Women's Day and we're dealing with two key issues that are impacting gender equality in the workplace. So first we'll be talking to Laura about ICTU's research on sexual harassment and Denise will discuss the gender pay gap and how we can address it. So Laura and Denise, you're both again very welcome on the show. Can you introduce yourselves and the work you do?
Thanks very much for having me on the show. So I'm Denise Roach and I'm the Legal and Policy Officer with the National Women's Council of Ireland. So I work across all our policy areas and I add the legal perspective where we think it'll be necessary. So that's kind of the kind of new laws that we need or changes that we need to make to current laws to increase gender equality. And I also run our newly established free employment law advice clinic for women.
Great. So again, thanks for having me here. So my name is Laura and I am your social policy officer at the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. So I always, when I'm asked to describe my job, I find it's easier to begin with what I don't do. So I'm not involved with organising workers, getting workers to join a trade union, nor am I involved in industrial relations. So strike action, pay negotiations, the bread and butter, top of mind issues that people tend to associate with trade unions. I've no hand, act or part in it. But what I do is I basically respond to any policy and legislation that's coming out of the Department of Social Protection and Employment Affairs. But because ICTU is a small operation, so we have around 30 full-time staff working across the Dublin and Belfast office, we tend to get dragged across different areas. And I suppose that is one of the reasons why I was the lead research on this piece of work we did on sexual harassment. Wouldn't be a traditional area you would find somebody charged with looking after social policy. But because my background is in social research and research methods, that's how this landed on my desk.
Great, thanks. And Laura, just to begin, can you start by telling us what sexual harassment is and what led ICTU to launch the survey that you've mentioned?
So the employment equality legislation defines sexual harassment as any form of unwanted, and unwanted is an important word there, any form of unwanted verbal, non-verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature that has the purpose or the effect of violating a person's dignity or creating some sort of hostile, humiliating environment for that individual. So in the first 2 weeks of November, ahead of the UN International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, we conducted an online survey of 1,300 trade union members with experience of sexual harassment in the workplace. And the purpose of our survey was to get a deeper understanding of sexual harassment, to find out more about the type of experience, the type of incident, the perpetrator, the location, any barriers to reporting, and the impact sexual harassment has on the lives of those affected. What the survey didn't do is it didn't measure how prevalent this issue was. But we know from existing research that one in three working women will experience some form of sexual harassment over their lifetime. So it didn't do that, but we know from other research what it does.
And one of the most alarming statistics that came out of this piece of research is that 4 out of 5 workers who experience sexual harassment at work do not report the incident. Why do you think that underreporting is so widespread?
So yeah, so that was one of the really shocking findings from it, that we are finding 80%, as you said, 4 in 5 people that experience it were taking no action. And that was either informal action by somebody going directly to their harasser or getting a third party to do it, or using the official channels to report the incident. although it was shocking, it was in line with the international research that's there. So we asked these people that said they had experienced it but hadn't pursued it why they did that. And the overriding response we got is out of a fear that this would have a negative impact on their career progression or their future relationships with their co-workers. So while the Me Too movement has been very successful in drawing attention to this and encouraging people to speak out, this was still a live issue. People were fearful of the consequences, the career consequences it would for them would have for them. For others, there was a feeling that it wouldn't be taken serious, they wouldn't be believed, and in some incidents, people actually believed that they would be blamed for the incident. So we found that really quite alarming. And then there was a small but still notable number of people that were either not aware that they could report or how to go about reporting. So a mixture of reasons, but the main issues coming out was they felt that the consequences for them reporting were just too big. They just decided not to report.
And then the people who did report, it seems the response is often shown to be unsatisfactory for them. So what did your research say?
So the 20%, the one in five that were reporting, we asked them about their experience of the reporting process. And we found that three quarters of them were dissatisfied with their employer's actions. Now, this would then feed into the large number of people that aren't reporting. So if you know from past experience that somebody in your workplace had reported before and there was no action, or the perpetrator was allowed to continue on in their job, there had been no repercussions for it, why would you go and report it? So if people are aware that the employer isn't dealing with it, giving it the same gravitas as they feel that is needed, that is in itself feeding into the large numbers of underreporting.
And what do you think that impact do you think that has on people who are affected by sexual harassment?
So that was another line of questions that we asked our respondents. We said, what has been the impact? So most people were embarrassed, and the embarrassment shouldn't come as a surprising finding, because the most common incident is verbal. So they are unwanted comments of a sexual nature, maybe about your body or your clothes. They could be verbal comments and remarks about your sex life. They could be unwanted jokes of a sexual nature. So the fact that the overriding impact was, or the most common impact was embarrassment, wasn't really surprising given the verbal. But for other people, it had an impact on their confidence at work. It made them feel cautious. They were cautious about getting into certain situations or being around certain people. It had a negative physical, psychological and professional. There were people reporting that although they weren't reporting the incident, the way that they were responding was by changing job, either in-house or by moving organisation.
As you know, the word Christmas parties has long been associated with events where sexual harassment may take place. But your research also shows the prevalence of online incidences of sexual harassment. Can you talk to us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so I suppose this was one of the biggest finding for us that wasn't really emerging from the existing research. First of all, the location, most common location for sexual harassment is in your work premises. Over half of incidents will happen there. But a significant number of the minority is happen at work events. So, of course, when there's maybe a few free drinks or a free bar, that's what's going to happen. And of course, the Christmas party, no surprise there, 20%, one in five, that's the incident. But coming close behind that, 1 in 7, 14% of the incidents was happening online. It was happening over social media or by the phone. So this is pointing to a growing problem in the modern workplace. And it would show that employers, even those that would think that they have pretty robust procedures in place, will need to look at it and update their manuals and procedures for dealing with sexual harassment, because a lot of these incidents are probably happening on work phones, work laptops, in work time, over social media and online.
And on that note, so there's a role for employers in this, but what needs to be done to combat sexual harassment in work, and what can be done to facilitate people reporting or having the confidence to report and that it'll be resolved?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, Anne-Marie, there is a role for employers, and it's more than a role, it's a legal obligation. So under the Employment Equality Act, it puts an onus on employers to have that policies and procedures in place that will both prevent it and deal with it. What we need to see is more proactive, urgent action from employers to make sure that they are to tackle this issue. So that can be things like raising awareness that such behaviour is unacceptable and may be subject to discipline, having those comprehensive procedures in place, but also making it accessible. So addressing that those people that aren't aware that they can report or how to report, and then having robust procedures in place for reporting, for supporting victims and for dealing with perpetrators. And there is also a role for the trade union movement, for letting our shop stewards and other people on the ground, both training them that they're able to deal with such, if they're approached by a trade union member, that this is a problem that they experience, but also highlighting it, that this is a service that we do offer to our members, that they can speak to the person in their workplace or ring directly FSU or Congress, that this is something that we're there to do. So we have a body of work to do, both in part of our training with people and then highlighting it, that this is a service a trade union offers to our members.
Yeah, that's really interesting. In the FSU, we're taking the month of March as a kind of time to highlight or to raise awareness on sexual harassment in the workplace. So it's going to involve training staff and reps, but then on top of that, to make sure that we're trained in how to deal with a case if someone comes forward and how to deal with that effectively. So that's
and it's really great to hear that you're doing that, because you know, taking that first step to approach somebody and say, I have this issue, it might be, as I said, it might be a verbal remark that the individual doesn't feel warrants going through the official channels, but they just want it to stop. And everybody deserves the right to have their dignity and well-being at work, but they don't feel themselves strong enough to approach the harasser themselves. So even the Department of Justice, they produce a code of practice, good guidelines. And in those guidelines, they say there should be designated people in place that a worker can go, and that then designated person can approach the harasser on the place. That's what trade unions are there. We have somebody in the workplace. They can fulfil that role. They are there to fulfil that role. But we also need to make sure that our people are trained enough, because if somebody has taken that important first step, it's really important both for that individual that the member knows how to respond, but it's also really important for our people that they're not put in a position where somebody is coming to them, confiding in them this really personal, you know, they're feeling exposed and they're feeling under pressure from this, and they don't have the right things to say. And so it's really in everybody's issue that this, it just becomes a natural part of our training and the services that we offer our members.
Denise, I was going to come to you straight away and talk to you about the gender pay gap, which is obviously a massive issue, not just at International Women's Day, but every day. But before we talk about that, I just wanted to, we were talking off mic about your experience running an employment advice service. Could you maybe just elaborate a little bit about that and what sort of issues are coming forward in that?
Sure. So we established this service back in October because we really saw a need. Women were reaching out. They knew that there was a problem or something wasn't right, but they actually didn't know how to enforce their rights or access their rights. So the clinic is just in relation to employment law issues. So the kind of things that we're hearing in the clinic are in relation to sexual harassment. But it would be the case of someone has gone to their HR and reported it, and they've taken that important step, but it's gone nowhere.
Okay.
And so they just end up leaving the job.
Nice.
Others who actually aren't in trade unions or don't have access to trade unions, who are in very vulnerable sectors, what exactly do they do? So that's women in the arts sector, for example. And we can see that today in the paper. There's a letter, over 200 artists are asking the Arts Council and the government to do something about sexual harassment and bullying, because there isn't really a lot. There isn't actually, people find that they are very alone.
Yeah.
And the other issue, and one that we're seeing constantly, is discrimination, particularly in relation to pregnancy. And while we do have very strong laws and a lot of protections in those areas, women are still being targeted because of their pregnancy. So, for example, a lady last week called. Now, she had dealt with the case, but she really just wanted to share her story. She had a very good career. She'd worked very hard. She was with this very large established company for quite some time. And 7 days after she told them she was pregnant, they offered her redundancy. Now, it's not illegal to do this, but it is illegal if you do it because the person is pregnant. But of course, you're left in this incredibly precarious position, and this is something that you're going to have to argue, and you're already in an incredibly vulnerable time. Now, the details of this case were such that it was very obviously discriminatory. She was lucky enough to be able to afford a really good solicitor and barrister in this case. But ultimately, it came down to the fact that they offered her a good enough redundancy package that would cover her during her maternity leave, or she could fight them and go to court, which could take 3 years, and during that time she would receive no money. So in that kind of situation, often women, and you cannot blame them, they take the money and they leave their job.
Yeah, it's quite shocking when you think about that and the impact that must have on people's lives.
Yeah, and when women reach out to the clinic, they actually don't really want to sue anyone. They don't want to go to court. All they want to do is do the job that they earned and that they're qualified for, that they have trained for, and they just want to go on with their working life. And what they're finding is that it's down to them to do something about this, that there's nowhere really to report or an employer. And actually, often when you talk to women in this situation, they're not the only woman in their organization who's experienced something like this.
I mean, I really find it's reprehensible that would happen to anybody in any sector. I'm very interested in your experience in dealing with those kind of situations, because you mentioned that this has happened in different sectors to different people.
We're trying to gather some research and some information, because there is very little data around this area. And actually, when we set about trying to get funding for the clinic several months ago, one of the things that we argued for is that there really isn't a huge amount of data. So we're quite indebted, actually, for putting such a great survey together and really showing what we already knew what was happening.
Yeah.
Is that women are being discriminated against. And it's very much down to the individual to take action or to bring about change. Should it be down to the individual?
And that's very problematic. I know we were just talking off mic again, that's very hard for an individual who could be isolated to take that kind of action, to stand up and be able.
But also, I mean, does it really change the culture of an organisation? Even if you are successful in your case, does that change what that company does?
Yeah.
There is no other repercussions. It's very much about the individual and the employer. So it doesn't really spark any sort of real change. And even if there are, as I understand it, the Workplace Relations Commission can add things to a judgment, say an employer has to do a certain thing, it's up to that individual to go back and tell the Workplace Relations Commission that this thing didn't happen. But often they've already left that job, because why would you stay in a job where you weren't really wanted?
Coming to the gender pay gap issue, Denise, I know that through your work you're involved as a legal and policy work with the National Women's Council of Ireland, obviously. Can we just define the parameters of the gender pay gap? What precisely is it when we speak of the gender pay gap? Because I know there's different sometimes understandings of it. What is it precisely, and what sectors is the pay gap most prevalent in?
Okay, well, when we're talking about the gender pay gap, it's actually made up of a number of different factors, and one of those factors is discrimination. And they all come together, and I like to see it as kind of numerical representation of systemic discrimination, a disadvantage that women suffer in work because they are women. So the figure that it has largely been talked about in the last several years is 13.9%. And this came from Eurostat, their EU agency. But recently, the CSO have published to say that the gender pay gap has increased to 14.9%. No, yeah, 14.4%, pardon me. Now, the increase could be down to the fact that we actually just came out of a recession, and during a recession, wages go down. So it wasn't that women may have made gains. It's more likely that men actually made losses. And that's why the pay gap went down. So we have this increase now of what looks like 14.4%. So as I said, it's made up of a number of factors. So one is discrimination. Another is that the sectors in which women work tend to pay less than sectors that predominantly male workers are in. Or when women are in organisations, they tend to be at the lower rung of the organisation and men tend to be at the higher rung of the organisation. Women have more career interruptions due to care, whether it's for young family members or elderly family members. And women then tend to take up more flexible working options. But the type of flexible working options are available are actually quite seen as career limiting. Because we're really focused on the idea of presenteeism rather than productivity.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing is if you opt for part-time work, again, there are not a lot of jobs, highly skilled jobs available on a part-time basis. Seniority is seen as full-time by default. So when women opt to take part-time work to balance their lives, they often have to downskill. And then again, you look at, as I said earlier, you have a lot more men in senior roles than women. And the glass ceiling and the sticky floor and such things are real.
Yeah.
Denise, what do you think of the school of thought that we don't in fact have a gender pay gap? What we have is a motherhood gap. That when we're looking at a childless woman or a woman without caring responsibilities, because of course we're seeing a lot of women with elder care now as mm-hmm. women remain in the workplace for longer and their parents are getting, you know, frail elderly and their care needs are coming up. That really, when you're comparing a woman with no care and responsibilities against a man, that the gap is either smaller or non-existent. But where you see the gap is, it's really when women start to have children and feeding into what you said previously. It's like, well, if you're going to get fired every time you're pregnant or, you know, not fired, but encouraged to leave.
Well, firstly, it's very funny. Women have babies, but, you know, men have children too.
Yeah.
So there's this overwhelming expectation that women take on, and they do take on the burden of care, and their careers suffer. There is a motherhood gap, and that is true, and it's also seen as a fatherhood benefit. But actually, there is other research coming out. I think New Zealand has recently published a very comprehensive study of their academics. So I think it is all their academics in New Zealand. And they looked at it, and they looked at, with everything being equal between academics, women still have half the chance of the kind of career progression of the professorships. That's right. And they categorically said it's not a baby issue and it's not an age issue. It's a woman issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the question that arises for me and all of this, Denise, is what is to be done? I know there's two issues that, again, we're just discussing off mic. One was around mandatory pay reporting. Mm-hmm. And the other was about pay transparency. And there's a European angle on that as well. And
definitely. So one of the steps that has been identified in the EU, and a lot of our European neighbours have already run with this, is wage transparency. And the first step to do that is to actually start looking more closely at employers and their actual companies. So taking the figures down to a company rather than looking at it as this very broad analysis of a whole country. So the government did accept this, and it was in our previous government in the last programme for government in 2016, and it did eventually emerge into the Gender Pay Gap Information Bill. Now, unfortunately, the bill didn't pass before the government fell, but we do hope that eventually, when we do get a new government, we'll see this bill back. So what this bill will do is that it will start to get employers to look at their, to start really looking at their data, like, are they hiring women? Are women leaving, and why are women leaving? Just really started breaking down their data. And after they break down their data, the bill will also say that they actually have to explain it, so have a narrative around their figures.
Okay.
And then after that, they're going to actually have to have an action plan. And they're going to have to say what they're going to do to close their gender pay gap. Now, there are some caveats with this bill. It's not a perfect bill. So, for example, it's going to be introduced on a phase basis. So this is, it's going to start with employers of 250 and it's going to go down over a 4-year period to 50, to employers who employ around 50 employees, but it won't go below than that. So it's only going to capture, I think, about 50% of our workforce. And that's why NWCI, FORSA, SIP2 and NIC2 all came together and said, actually, this bill needs, the figures need to go down to 20. This reporting needs to go down to 20. The other thing about this bill, it's going to be some time before we even actually see reporting, because even once the bill is passed and it becomes law, we're going to have to wait for regulations. And once the regulations are published, then I think it's a 2 years before we'll ever see our first report.
Okay.
So, it's a bit slow, and we would argue that there's no need for it. Everyone is ready, and everyone is expecting it.
Yeah, and what's the need for the delay? What's the,
million-dollar question.
Yeah. And just to come back, go ahead, Laura.
It was just something you mentioned yourself, Paul, about what's happening over in Europe, and we're seeing it with the European Trade Union Congress, and they only this week, Esther Lynch, who used to do my job, so big shoes to fill, she was leading on the campaign this week, looking for a European directive that will end pay secrecy clauses in contracts. So some people might be aware of that. It's not unusual, maybe in senior roles, when you get that role, your contract of employment will have a clause in it to say you're not allowed to discuss internally and externally how much you're getting for the job. And I know from speaking off mic, Denise was saying this is something the National Council of Women have long been calling for an end to this. So I was just wondering, Denise, is it, and the two things might be related, but do you have any opinion on encouraging or requiring that every time a job is advertised, it comes with what the pay is? Is that something that could address pay inequality and gaps?
That's something that we've been calling for as well, that you actually, when you advertise a job, that you should actually also advertise the salary bands.
Well,
not just that you would have to say what the benefits are on offer.
Yeah.
So this is particularly important for women when it comes to maternity leave. At what point during the negotiation process or during the interview process is it appropriate for you to ask about maternity leave? Do they top up, or are they only offering statutory maternity leave? Are there service requirements before you're entitled to maternity leave? Is there a clawback? Because in some contracts, women who return from maternity leave, if they change jobs in a certain period of time after the maternity leave, the employer can actually claw back that money. So these are things that should be very obvious and open. Because when you go to an interview, you're disclosing everything. You're giving them your CV. You're going to an interview. You're submitting to a large number of questions. You're probably doing a presentation. God, there could be another interview. They have all this information about you. And then you get asked, what's your salary expectation? Or worse, they'll ask you what you're currently earning.
Yeah.
And this is something that we vehemently say must be stopped. Because if you come from a lower earning industry, which is most women work in lower earning industries, and you're moving into an industry that pays much more money, they're going to base your salary not on your skills, your experience,
what you've been willing to work for to date.
Willing to work for date.
Very conscious of what you're saying in terms of wage transparency impacts and a lot of the work that myself and Anne-Marie will be very familiar with in organising workers. It's often that secrecy is used as a kind of a disciplinary way, and it's to set people against each other, and you impose a set of fear. Oh, I couldn't possibly disclose my salary. I can't tell anybody. And obviously, it would be better if that were lifted.
Yeah, and I think also that now that we've come out of a recession, there would have been an, I had the misfortune of entering the workforce from university in January 2011. And I still look back at those charts of the drop in unemployment. It was still falling for a following year before it went up. So obviously the pay that I was willing to accept in January 2011 was much more reduced than my expectations coming back with a PhD. So people started working at a lower rate. Then time moved on. The organisation is then recruiting. So what they could get me for a starting salary isn't necessarily the same 24 months later, my colleague that's sitting beside me. And if you're not internally allowed to speak up about what your salary was, you know, there's a lot of people, their starting salary was much more reduced during those years, and they should be entitled to a clawback. Now, I know the public services have their particular issues because it was done wide sweeping, but at the private sector as well, you will have people that started on a much reduced pay scale than was ever there before. And I think that they have a right to get some sort of reverse clawback.
but even if you can't get a reverse clawback, you're basically stalked by this low wage for the rest of your career.
Absolutely.
Unless, you know, you're the good fortune of an employer who doesn't ask that question or isn't interested in asking that question. This is something actually they're looking at in the UK, and I know the Fawcett Society have actually published a bill about giving women the right to ask what their colleague earns if they suspect he's earning quite substantially more than them, so that they're able to take that information and to prove that, to prove their equal pay case in work.
Yeah. Well, Laura and Denise, I just want to say thank you both very, very much for joining us. It's been very highly illuminating for me, and thank you very much. Hopefully we'll be continue this conversation again into the future. Just to say also, for more information about some of the topics on the show, check out fsunion.org and FSU social media during the month of March, because we're going to be dealing with some of these issues again. And of course, if you wish to join the FSU, if you work in banking, finance or tech, fsunion.org/join, you would be very welcome. And check out, of course, the officeblock.org and officeblock on social media as well, the OB tweets on Twitter, or just the officeblock on Facebook, and you'll have again more information about this and other issues there. So thanks to everyone at the Financial Services Union, thanks to everyone at Headstuff, and until the next time, thank you.
Thank you very much.